Good morning. Court's ready to hear argument in Rapacelli versus State Farm. Are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Morning, Mr. Zappa.
Good morning, Your Honors. Richard Zappa and Lauren Hudecki for the plaintiff below appellant Joseph Rapacelli. Your Honors, the issue before the court today is whether or not the action that was pled, litigated, and tried in the Delaware Superior Court that resulted in a final judgment in Rapacelli's favor for compensatory damages for bodily injuries arising out of a tort is within the scope of the prejudgment interest penalty provisions.
Does that statement of the questions presuppose that if it wasn't pled or tried or litigated as a tort case, that it wouldn't be a tort case?
No, Your Honor. That's why I left out the word tort when I described the action. If the action that was tried in the court, pled, litigated, and tried, that resulted in what I just described as a final judgment for compensatory damages for bodily injuries, if that is within the scope of the language of that statute, that's what this court has to decide.
Well, what's the critical consideration? I mean, it's admitted by everyone that the claim for uninsured motorists derives from a contract of insurance.
That is correct.
And of course, what was litigated was also a claim for compensation for personal injury, which
true.
Would be at fault. So, how do we deal with that?
Okay, Your Honor, our position is that the language of the statute, taken as a whole, and interpreted in the light of the objective of the statute and its legislative intent, make the exclusion of Rapacelli's underinsured motorist claim an unintended, if not an absurd, result. And the reason for that is because the analysis that the court did really was simplistic, and in its simplicity, it ended prematurely. It was simplistic because the court relied on this court's holding in Allstate versus Spinelli and concluded that simply because the contract features of an uninsured motorist claim predominated for purposes of determining the appropriate statute of limitations for the bringing of claims against first-party insurers, that for all purposes, a litigation involving a claim against a first-party insurer for either uninsured motorist or underinsured motorist had to be, in a pure sense, considered a breach of contract action. And we just think that analysis was wrong. Because the court took the opinion in Allstate versus Spinelli and said this has to be treated as a breach of contract action, then it focused only on the word tort action in the statute and didn't consider all of the language. Rapacelli relies on the language of the statute in support of his position. We rely on the words any tort action, any final judgment, with an emphasis on the word any, and the words compensatory damages for bodily injuries, which can only be recovered in tort. And that's what Rapacelli was suing for. And more importantly, perhaps most importantly, we believe the purposeful selection of the word defendant, which is a generic term that is better defined and understood when you refer to the synopsis to the bill. And it's clear from the synopsis that this statute was intended to apply not only to the wrongdoer, that is the tortfeasor, but also to the contractual indemnitors, namely the insurance companies. And if you look at the synopsis and you say that the General Assembly is telling us that the purpose of this statute is to apply globally to end litigations in the Delaware Superior Court and Court of Common Pleas to reduce court congestion, then it makes sense that defendant in the statute has to be given its proper weight, and it includes insurance companies.
The Superior Court, conceded that there were tort elements that are mixed up in this claim, but held that the tort aspect was really went to the measure of recovery rather than to the nature of the claim. Let's change the facts for a moment. Let's assume that in this case the uninsured or underinsured carrier offered an appropriate amount in settlement, whatever that amount may be, but then at the last minute refused to pay it over, and your client was forced to sue to recover it. What kind of a case would that be?
That's a contract action where you can't look to Section 2301D. If, in fact, you're suing to enforce a settlement, what matters under this statute is whether the claim that's filed can result in a final judgment for the recovery of compensatory damages. And that can only occur in a tort-based claim. If you're suing because you say you settled the case, you're suing on a breach of contract, and 2301D would be unavailable. The analysis we believe that the court should have applied, Your Honors, is...
So there would be no prejudgment interest if the proper amount or if an adequate amount were offered but then was held back wrongfully?
Oh, no, there would be, Your Honor, because it's a liquidated sum on a breach of contract that's known at the time of the breach. You recover under a different theory. You recover under the contract theory that you can recover for prejudgment interest as long as at the time of the breach the damages are calculable. But you can't do that in a tort claim. It just doesn't happen. And it doesn't happen in an uninsured motorist claim. And with all due respect to the trial court, it's a little naive to say that this is a breach of contract action when, in fact, Your Honors, there never was any breach between State Farm and Rapicelli. They had the right under the contract to have issues of damages and the liability of the underinsured motorist decided in a forum. Now, if they have that right to assert under a contract, there's no breach until there's a verdict and they don't pay it. Only then do you have a breach of contract. We think those distinctions, whether this is a tort issue or this sounds more like a contract matter, are the artificial distinctions that in Travelers Indemnity versus Lake were found sort of unimportant for determining the choice of law issue. It transcended the issue of whether is it more tort claim or is it more a uninsured motorist claim. Now, Your Honors, we really now think that the analysis the trial court should have used is that which this court used in Harris against Newcastle County.
You take the court for task for not analyzing the case in terms of Harris?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
You're taking the lower court to task for not using Harris as the template for analysis?
No. I think that, Your Honor, the court was obliged to apply that same kind of analysis. We argued that it should have. We didn't cite the court to Harris, but...
No, nor did you cite us to Harris in your opening brief, nor did the other side cite Harris in its answering brief. That's why I'm asking the question. It sort of flies up from out of the blue in the reply brief for the first time, I believe.
Well, it's in response, Your Honor, to State Farm's position that the fact that tort action is the focus of this court's interpretation of the language of that statute, that we rebut that argument by saying, well, wait a minute. Just because the word tort action appears in this statute doesn't end the analysis. And the court ended the analysis prematurely. And we argue that in our opening brief, that it ended prematurely because it focused solely on the Allstate versus Spinelli.
Well, if as I understand the thrust of the argument in your reply brief, Harris is basically essentially an all fours with this case.
The analysis is wrong.
The analysis is, and that it basically is the controlling rule of law. And if that's true, then I would have thought it would have been argued front and center in the opening brief.
Well, our opening position was that the statute led to an absurd result if you gave it a literal interpretation. And that's really our principal argument, and it allows us to get into the synopsis to understand what the intent of the General Assembly was in passing the bill.
So Harris is not essential to your position?
It is essential in the sense that we argue that that analysis should apply, but the statute was a different statute, so it wasn't like we had a case out there that applied that same logic and that same interpretive analysis to the statute that we had. But once State Farm takes the position that for all purposes, simply because the word action and tort appear in the statute, that it has to be interpreted in such a way to exclude claims that have their genesis in a contract of insurance but don't necessarily involve the litigation of the tort issues, but more importantly, the objective of the statute being satisfied. That's why we cited Harris.
You indicate that it would lead to an absurd result, but the other side tells us
it would, not using these words, lead to an unfair result to have interest run from the date of the injury when this particular type of carrier wouldn't even know that they had any exposure for a long time after that. And so why isn't their response to your absurd result argument, you know, persuasive?
It's unpersuasive for two reasons. One, there is no unfairness. The legislature determined that the penalty is going to apply back at the time of the injury. It could have determined time of the filing of the suit. The fact that the right of action doesn't mature until after the tort occurs is irrelevant for purposes of the penalty. It's equally applies to first-party and third-party insurers. This penalty only applies to filed actions. It's based on when the action is filed. So we don't buy into the unfairness argument. But, you know, more importantly, I guess we could say that the global issue behind the statute is to end the litigations and to compel or incentivize defendants, and we believe that's wrongdoer or insurance companies, to accept reasonable settlement proposals. And it doesn't matter. The reason it's an absurd result, we'd have to sit here and say, the General Assembly actually sat here and said, we want this global objective accomplished by penalizing defendants for forcing these cases into to be litigated fully and then tried. And yet, and we're limiting it now to cases where we know if the final judgment is based on a sort of tort-based recovery, that we're going to exclude first-party insurers but include third-party insurers. And we don't believe, at least our position is, that the General Assembly actually sat there and said, well, by putting tort in there, and that was a redundancy that was added afterwards, it didn't have to be added. That original bill was passed during the same legislative session. It wasn't signed by the governor until later. They made an amendment to the statute to add tort, even though if they hadn't done it, it would have still only applied to tort-based claims.
So you're saying we should construe tort action to mean tort-based claims?
I'm saying, Your Honor, that to understand how to define tort action, you have to take the word any in front of it, then you have to look to any final judgment, then you have to take the words compensatory damages for bodily injuries and the generic term defendant. When you put it together and apply the Harris versus Newcastle County analysis, you will be defeating the objective of the statute.
Mr. Zampa,
yes.
Let me, I was going to ask the same question that Justice Holland did, but I'll do it in a different way. If we were to agree with your position, whatever ruling we make has to be expressed in terms of a doctrine or a rule of law that's rooted in the statute. If I were to ask you to summarize what that rule would be in a sentence, how would you do it?
That to give this statute the interpretation that the trial court gave it leads to an unintended, if not absurd, result, because the language of the statute, what I pointed out, if is global enough to include claims that have their genesis in a contract. It doesn't matter whether the claims have their genesis in a statute or in a contract of insurance like this one. So because it leads to a result that would be unintended, Your Honor, the words tort action in the statute have to be given a sensible and reasonable interpretation.
Well, you're, to state it somewhat differently, your position, if I understand it correctly, is that the language, any tort action, must be construed to include a recovery for uninsured motorists. That is uninsured motorist recovery, correct?
That is correct. If it's a filed action in court where it can lead to a final judgment.
And my question is, there has to be a because clause after that.
Because to give the interpretation of the statute a different result and exclude these would lead to an absurd result or an unintended result that conflicts with the objective of the statute. And when that happens, the rule of law is that you disregard that interpretation in favor of one that advances the objective. And that's the golden rule of statutory interpretation. So we're relying on that rule. If to give the language a literal interpretation, tort action has to mean only a pure traditional tort claim. If you give it that interpretation, then you defeat the objective of the statute. And that rule is pretty well laid out here by decisions in this court, that you don't do that. You, in fact, look to the statute, the totality of the language, and then just like they did in Harris versus Newcastle County, and said, hey, wait a minute, we're defeating the objective of that statute if we allow the employee to make a double recovery at the expense of the employer, even though the same language is used in that statute, tort action.
Did you want to save your remaining time?
Thank you, Your Honor, I do.
Good morning, Ms. Fallon.
Good morning, Justice Holland. Good morning, Justice Berger and Justice Jacobs. Sherry Fallon for State Farm. First of all, I want to thank the court for permitting me to appear in place of Susan Housky, who cannot appear for medical reasons. We would respectfully ask that this court affirm the decision of Judge Tolliver and find that the court did not err in denying prejudgment interest under Section 2301D. Section 2301, before the addition of subsection D, has always been and remains our contractual interest statute. Subsection D was added to include tort suits where a defendant had an opportunity to settle but refused, forcing the case to trial. And if the result was not as favorable as the settlement demand, the defendant pays for the resulting delay to the plaintiff in collecting the compensatory damages by an assessment of prejudgment interest running back to the date of the accident. Rules of statutory construction are not necessary to expand the scope of 2301D.
You would agree that 2301D applies to third-party insurers, correct?
Well,
that is the liability insurer for the tortfeasor defendant.
Let me answer it this way, Your Honor, and I don't mean to be cagey about it, but we're all aware of the fiction, the tripartite fiction, where the defendant, the insured, is the named party in the suit, but the insurer, the liability insurer, is really is a real party in interest in the sense that they retain defense counsel, they pay defense costs, they pay judgments from the policy limits. But it's clear from the amendment 2301D that it was intended to apply to a third-party tort action. That's exactly what the statute says.
Well, let's simplify the matter. Let's assume we have an insolvent tortfeasor defendant, and everybody knows that the only money behind that defendant is the liability policy. And let's further assume that all of the conditions that would trigger prejudgment interest prescribed by the statute arise.
Right.
There would be a proper claim under 2301D against the liability carrier, would there not?
It would be against the defendant, which the liability carrier would pay as the insurer for that insolvent defendant. So long as that defendant has a policy of insurance, he's still the named party in the suit. It's still a third-party tort action.
Well, formally, yes.
It doesn't change the nature of the action, and the insurer would presumably pay the prejudgment interest if
the answer is yes.
Met. Yes.
All right. So on what principled basis can we distinguish between a payment under those facts by the third-party insurer and a payment by an underinsured carrier?
Because the underinsured claim is based upon contract, and the underinsured.
Well, so is the obligation to pay the third party claim.
The obligation arises from the plaintiff's suit against the defendant, as opposed to deriving from a contract purchased by the plaintiff from an insurer.
But this case also arose from a plaintiff's suit. It was tried litigated no differently from any personal injury case, except that what was really at stake was the underinsured coverage.
It was litigated, Your Honor, as an underinsured motorist case. The transcript, which is appended to the plaintiff's appendix, to the appellant's appendix, indicates that Mr. Zappa, in opening comments, talked about payment of premiums, the bargain that the plaintiff made with his insurer for this coverage, the amount of the coverage, the amount recovered from the underinsured tortfeasor, and that the fact that the plaintiff was looking for the benefit of his bargain. Those comments were repeated in closing remarks. The case was, as far as the measure of damages, certainly the proof to prove damages is similar, as is proven in a tort case with a plaintiff seeking tort damages from a third party, but the case was litigated, styled, and defended as a contract action.
I mean, was there were the words uninsured motorist coverage expressed to the jury?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Absolutely. In the transcript, there are several references to it. At page A168, for example, the argument was made, we're here because a document, policy insurance, it's a contract. This policy insurance, Joe Rapazzelli is from State Farm, and it's called underinsured motorist coverage. And what he did is he paid extra money when he purchased his liability coverage to buy insurance that covers you in the event you have an accident. And it goes on to state how much he bought in insurance. And the same type of comments are made in closing remarks as well, Your Honor, even bringing up the State Farm advertisement about being the good neighbor and whatnot.
So is it those types of comments on which you rest your position?
In order to distinguish it from a third-party tort action, certainly. But there is a legal basis for it as well, and that stems from this court's line of cases, beginning with Allstate versus Spinelli, and the way the court has viewed underinsured motorist claims and uninsured motorist claims as breach of contract actions. In order to recover under those types of actions, the plaintiff has to prove a legal entitlement to recover from the underinsured tortfeasor, and they also have to establish that damages exceed what the underinsured tortfeasor paid. And
How does the Harris versus Newcastle County impact your position?
I think it's an opposite, Your Honor. I respectfully submit that it doesn't control the outcome in this case. That statute has a very different wording. It consists of two sentences. The first sentence is the sentence that contains the reference to a tort action. And when the court decided Harris, it expressly stated that the reference in the first sentence of the workers' compensation lien statute, and in particular the words, in an action in tort, evidence unambiguous legislative intent with respect to the breadth of the employer's right of subrogation. That is, it's in there because it exists to define the measure of damages. It was the court indicated that so viewed, the words in an action in tort cannot be said to define the scope of an employer's right of subrogation. The court relied upon the second sentence, and in particular the words any recovery, and it said any recovery must be taken to intend subrogation to be all-inclusive. That's not what we have here. We have a very specific language in 23.01D that says in any tort action for compensatory damages, and then it goes on to state brought in the superior court and in the court of common pleas seeking monetary relief for bodily injuries. Had the legislature intended to include all sorts of all-encompassing actions as in Harris, it could have just simply stated in any action, as was stated in the original draft of the legislation. The legislation, as adopted, included the word tort to modify action. So the fact, the words that the court relied upon in the Harris case, any recovery, and interpreting that broadly to include any type of recovery, inclusive of uninsured motorist benefits provided by the same employer who's providing the workers' comp benefits is not present in 2301D. We have a limitation limited to tort actions. The word defendant follows in that sentence because it's the only logical word to choose because it refers to actions brought in a court. So you,
well, the court in Harris did not conclude that the action to recover uninsured motorist, the uninsured motorist proceeds, was an action in contract, did it?
Your Honor, I would respectfully submit to the court that it did. As Your Honor brought up, Harris was not mentioned in until the reply brief, so I never had an opportunity to comment on it.
Well, it was argued below, was it not?
I'm sorry?
I mean, you were not unaware of it. It was argued to Judge Tolliver, was it not?
I don't recall Harris being brought up to Judge Tolliver. Mr. Zappa can certainly correct me on that point, but Harris involved a situation where the employer provided the uninsured benefits in addition to the workers' compensation benefits. Harris was later construed by this honorable court in another situation where the uninsured benefits at issue were not purchased by the insurer but were purchased by the actual insured, and that was the Adams case interpreting Harris. And in Adams, the it was stated that the Delaware courts have consistently applied principles of contract to a subrogation claim in the context of a workers' compensation proceeding when that claim originated with the act of a third-party tortfeasor. And that is cited in the Adams versus Delmarva Power case. Harris did not...
Well, the court in Harris did appear to rest the holding on the second sentence of the statute, which said that any recovery against a third party creates a subrogation, right? But in the opinion, the court also used language that suggests that the court virtually held that in any event, this was a tort action. The court on page 1309 says, we agree with the Superior Court's characterization of Harris's recovery, though received from the county's uninsured motorist carrier. The sum involved represents the damages the third-party tortfeasor would be required to pay upon adjudication of guilt in a tort action, but for his lack of insurance.
Correct, Your Honor, and I would respectfully submit that that goes to the measure of damages, not the characterization of the action. It doesn't appear that Harris changed the characterization of an action to recover underinsured benefits from a contract action to a tort.
But didn't Harris action also say that the characterization, that was not the analysis that controlled?
Because of the language relating to any recovery in that particular statute, which is absent from this particular statute, 2301D, the way it's used in this statute is that it has to be a tort action filed in a court of record, Superior Court, a court of common pleas, seeking money damages for bodily injuries. We don't have a second or more expansive sentence following that stating that any time a demand is made for settlement against in any type of action, then any recovery must include the assessment of prejudgment interest if there was an opportunity to settle but didn't. Also, Your Honor, with regard to the absurdity of the result, it's State Farm's position that, you know, a situation results in complete unfairness to the insured, underinsured motorist carrier if the argument supported by the plaintiff is adopted. It results in a situation where a carrier is backcharged for interest to the date of an accident, a situation over which the carrier certainly had no control, and that's...
Well, let me interrupt there. Am I misunderstanding? If the carrier had simply paid on the demand, then there wouldn't be the additional charge, would there?
The case would resolve for the amount of the settlement and would not go on to trial. I'm not sure I'm following. I apologize if I'm not following the court's question.
If I understand the way the statute works, you get the prejudgment interest only if you've made a demand for payment and the defendant refuses to pay, and then you obtain a judgment at least as high as your demand.
Correct.
So assuming this statute applied to the underinsured carrier, your argument is, well, you know, the underinsured carrier isn't even in the case until later on, and how unfair would that be to have to pay prejudgment interest and so on. But you wouldn't pay prejudgment interest if the carrier had agreed to the amount of the demand, right?
No party would pay prejudgment interest if the case resolved at settlement. The problem with the scenario involving an underinsured motorist carrier is that, as in this case, the record reflects that the plaintiff did not even place State Farm on notice of the potential underinsured claim until more than 2 years after the settlement occurred with the underlying tortfeasor. The plaintiff settled with the underinsured tortfeasor, Ms. Stanford, for $15,000 in May of 2004, and the record reflects that the letter putting State Farm, quote unquote, on notice of the potential underinsured motorist claim was not sent until December of 2006. Now, State Farm has no control over all of that delay, and then for the plaintiff to come here and say, well, guess what, we are entitled to go back and receive that interest for all that time that elapsed over which State Farm had absolutely no control is an absurd result, which would occur if the court were to give it the construction the plaintiff advocates.
Okay, but isn't the idea behind this statute to encourage settlements that are, you know, at least determined post hoc to be reasonable?
Certainly, Your Honor. And in first-party claims for contractual benefits, whether they be underinsured claims, PIP claims, no-fault claims, there is the availability of extra contractual damages to the plaintiff for any unreasonable or unjustified conduct on the part of its insurer, for bad faith or breach of an implied covenant of fair dealing and good faith. So there are remedies available to correct any problems, and this court...
But I guess what I'm trying to get at, and maybe I'm just misunderstanding here, if the goal of the statute is to encourage reasonable settlements, reasonable being settlements that are later proved that were what a jury would have come back with at least. So the idea is to encourage reasonable settlements, and the defendant is at risk. If you don't want to settle, that's fine, but you now are face the potential added damages of having to pay prejudgment interest. What difference does it make whether your added risk is prejudgment interest from date A or date B? In either case, the point is the defendant has to make a choice, and part of that choice is loaded, you know, it's in to encourage you to settle if the offer is reasonable, if the demand is reasonable, because you know that you face prejudgment interest.
Because the standard is applied differently and it prejudices an insurer, unlike a regular defendant in a third-party case. When I see that my time is almost up, but I want to address that question. A defendant in a third-party tort case, when that accident occurs, if that party's at fault, they have reason to know that they're potentially a defendant within the next 2 years for the personal injury statute of limitations. If they're insured by a liability carrier, their insurer knows it too. They're potentially a defendant. They know that if they get a settlement demand, if that case goes into suit, that they're potentially liable for prejudgment interest from the date of the accident. That is not the case here. The plaintiff can delay for many years. In this case, it was more than 2 years, in even giving notice to the underinsured motorist carrier, such that the underinsured motorist carrier is penalized by the additional passage of time that doesn't occur in a third-party liability case, but penalized by the additional passage of time that is totally within the control of the plaintiff that the carrier has no control over and is subject, will always be subject, to a number of years which could translate into significant dollar damages depending on the number of years that go by before the notice is given and before the case ever gets to trial. And as I said, the remedies are available through extra contractual damages to the extent that there are alleged unfair practices going on in the settlement negotiations and the insurer's position is unreasonable. You don't need to penalize them with prejudgment interest in order to assert a claim that they acted unreasonably in considering a settlement demand in a first-party case. I see that my time is up. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Your Honors, first of all, the Harris case, we truly believe, is on all fours as far as the analysis is concerned. And the proposition that's cited in it, and it's a universal one, so it isn't just Harris that's citing it, it's this proposition, that applying the rule of construction, that is, it was decided, but based on applying the rule of construction that, quote, underlying legislative intent takes precedence over a literal interpretation of statutory construction. A statutory language that arguably supports a contrary result. And that's the problem with the argument the State Farm advances, is that the statute makes no sense. Harris is on all fours because this first sentence versus second sentence actually is in a parallel argument to the very statute that we're here to talk about. Because any tort action is in the first part, whereas these very important words are in 2301D, that the prejudgment interest shall be added to any final judgment. They are the critical and operative words, just as in Harris. They were critical and operative in defining the any recovery so that the rule of subrogation would apply irrespective of whether the payment was coming from a contractual indemnitor. There is absolutely no difference between a third-party insurer's interest and a first-party insurer's interest. Does it really matter? We have three scenarios that play out. Is it going to depend on the fortuitous circumstance whether the tortfeasor is insured, uninsured, or underinsured as to whether the penalty should apply? A penalty that the General Assembly clearly intended to be global. I mean, there's a multitude of claims filed every day, uninsured and underinsured motorist claims in court.
Well, Ms. Fallon does argue, I think, with factual accuracy, that the circumstances of an underinsured carrier are different from those of the liability carrier, in that the liability carrier, which is given notice, has some ability to control, has early involvement in the case, which is not the case necessarily with an uninsured carrier. An uninsured carrier can be brought into the case long after the critical facts have taken place, and therefore any potential liability for prejudgment interest goes beyond the control, at least the early control of the uninsured carrier. So from there it's argued that because there's a functional difference between the two types of carriers, there is justification for treating them differently. What is your response?
My response is that, all due respect to the defendant's position here, that it just makes no sense at all. Because the operative word of control, and I think Justice Berger pointed it out, it's retained by the defendant in the case. The penalty doesn't even apply until there's a filed action. And it's just as available to a first-party insurer as it is to a third-party insurer who can accept the reasonable settlement proposal. There's no unfairness built into this simply because the opportunity to end the litigation, which is what the goal of the statute is, it isn't really settle claims before they get into court, although that was a secondary reason as to why they went back to the time of the injury. They wanted the penalty to be heavy, to encourage it even before it gets a filed action. So our answer to that question is there's no unfairness, and it doesn't matter one bit whether the decision being made to reject a reasonable settlement offer is being made by somebody sitting behind a desk at State Farm, wearing a hat of a contractual indemnitor as a third-party person indemnifying the tortfeasor, or a first party for purposes of the goal of the statute. I think I have 33 seconds. The other thing is I wanted to mention is the absurd result argument. Well, there's the rule of statutory construction that if you give the statute an interpretation and it leads to mischievous results, that you don't accept that as a proposition. Well, here's the mischievous results. First-party insurers will do exactly what they did and have done it to Rapacelli as to other insurers. There's no downside if this statute doesn't impose any penalty on first-party insurers, because contrary to what State Farm has indicated to the court, it's much more difficult to make a claim of bad faith against a first-party insurer who can say we were simply relying on our contract to have damages assessed and the tort issues resolved. Whereas a first-party insurer or third-party insurer, we can sue them in a claim for excess liability, where all that we have to show is they failed to exercise reasonable care. I'd have to show State Farm acted in bad faith, much more difficult. Your Honors, if we don't apply the global goal of this statute to first-party insurers, then they will, unfortunately, do what they've done in this case again and again. Thank you.
Thank you both. The court will take this matter under advisement. We're also going to take a short recess.
We are.